This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
We're about to introduce you to Mary and a red tomato. Mary's an imaginary person living in bizarre circumstances, of which more anon. Her creator is a distinguished Australian philosopher. When Frank Jackson dreamed up Mary, it was to use as an intellectual weapon against a physicalist or materialist, against those who believe that the only things that exist in the world are physical. Professor Jackson used to believe that Mary believed there were mental states distinct from physical states, and that these mental states were epiphenomenal, i.e. they had no influence on physical states. But back to Mary and what she knew about that tomato.
Frank Jackson, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you very much, Nigel.
We're going to talk about a very famous thought experiment, what Mary knew, and you're responsible for that thought experiment. Could you just begin by telling us how you came up with it?
There's a bit of history. I used to be at Monash, and that was back in the days when nearly all philosophers of mind were materialists, and the psychology department discovered that there was a dualist in the philosophy department, and they said, let's ask this dualist across to give us a lunchtime talk and explain how you could possibly not be a materialist. So in the spirit of interdepartmental cooperation, I said, yes, that sounds like a good idea. But then, of course, I had to think of something to talk about. But I said, well, I've always thought that the sensory side of psychology, the feely bit, the pains and the itches and the tickles and the red sunsets, all that stuff, that was the bit that materialism couldn't handle. So I said, right, I'll tell the psychologists what the best argument is for saying that gets left out. And I just wanted the clearest argument that would sort of spell out exactly why the feely side got left out.
So what is the argument that you came up with?
Well, I said, the idea the feely side's left out is the idea that if you tell everything there is to say that materialists talk about, brain states and functional states and processing information and everything that AI people talk about, if you say everything there is to say in those terms, you somehow left something out. Now, what's a good way of making that vivid? Imagine someone who knew everything materialist talks about, but never had an experience of red. Wouldn't they be ignorant about something? And that was the idea behind the knowledge argument.
So the knowledge argument is a bit more detailed than that. It's not just imagining somebody who hasn't had experience of red, but somebody who's had a completely monochromatic experience up to that point.
Yes, you imagine someone who's confined to a black and white room. They're painted black and white. They never cut their hands. They never see any red blood. The room is full of books in black and white, TV, which is black and white, and wonderful lectures by the world's greatest neuroscientists, all done in black and white. That's all inside the room. And she's never been outside the room. And she's called Mary. You say, right, she then gets to be the world's greatest functionalist psychologist, neuroscientist, expert on physics and chemistry. But she's never seen anything looking red. You open the door and you let her go out. Won't she say, my goodness, there's a whole aspect of life which I didn't know about. That's the knowledge argument. You can know all there is in the black and white terms, and yet somehow something's missing. There's something more to know.
Now, when she does go out of the room, philosophers usually describe the experience that she has as her experience of qualia.
Yes. The basic thought is she learns something exciting about what the world is like. Being philosophers, we want some nice labels for this. And the word qualia is just a nice label for her. It's a word for the feely side of looking red.
But in the thought experiment, there shouldn't be anything extra because she knows absolutely everything that you could possibly know about the neuropsychology, so she should not be surprised in the least.
If materialism or physicalism is true, the line of thought and the argument is you shouldn't be surprised at all. And of course she does know while she's inside the room that people use the word red on occasion. She reads in these black and white books that people say things like, sunsets look red. And they say things like the experience of red is rather more vivid and exciting than the experience of pale grey. She knows all that. But the thought is there's something she doesn't know. She doesn't actually know the nature of the state which underlies those remarks she reads about. Now, let me hasten to add, of course, I no longer believe the conclusion of the thought experiment. I'm now a card-carrying materialist, but that's a later part of the story.
Let's just get to the conclusion that you wanted to deliver when you first gave this paper. You described the thought experiment, and presumably there was a punchline.
Well, the punchline was that what she learns are extra properties, and the conclusion is physicalism is false. But I also said we know enough about how the world works to say that these extra properties don't do any causing. To use the philosopher's jargon, they're epiphenomena. So that's the reason the original paper was called Epiphenomenal Qualia, because the idea is we've got to believe in these qualia, but we also have to say, as good scientists, that they're epiphenomenal. The extra properties don't affect the words that come out of my mouth or the movements of my hand or what goes in my brain.
Just to get this straight, what you're saying is that although I might have these experiences, I can describe brain states and muscular changes and physiological reactions and so on in my body without any need to bring in these qualia to explain what's going on.
If you ask neuroscientists to explain what happens in our brain and how those happenings lead to changes in our vocal cords and movements in our arms and so on, they never have to invoke anything outside entities and properties they deal with in the neuroscience lab.
Now, I can't believe the materialists just rolled over when they heard your argument. So what kind of counter-arguments did they come up with?
A very large number. The literature is enormous, and as I often say, lots of materialists thought there was some obvious error in the argument. I got a bit consoled, though, by the fact that they nearly always thought the obvious error was different. But yes, they came up with lots of things. They said epiphenomenalism is unbelievable, and indeed that was a consideration that eventually made me change my mind.
So why did you change your mind?
Well, the biggest factor was the picture of myself writing epiphenomenal qualia, but not being caused to write epiphenomenal qualia by qualia. I said in epiphenomenal qualia that you had to be an epiphenomenalist about qualia, and what that meant was that qualia didn't change the words that came out of my mouth or the movements of my, this was back in the pen days, the movements of my pen on pieces of paper. So it meant that when I gave the talk defending epiphenomenal qualia, and I wrote the paper defending epiphenomenal qualia, the qualia weren't causing the talk and they weren't causing the writing. And I just decided this was sort of unbelievable. Now, epiphenomenal qualia does have a section in which it says you can live with epiphenomenalism. It all fits together nicely. It says it's perfectly reasonable to believe that the world is a more mysterious place than you might have thought. But it was the picture of myself writing the paper uncaused by the qualia. I said, I can't believe this. And I came to think that was a triumph of philosophical cleverness over common sense.
But just because the qualia aren't doing anything, epiphenomenal things don't do anything. That's the point of epiphenomenal entities. They don't actually have a causal power, so it shouldn't surprise you that they're not doing anything.
Oh, no, it shouldn't surprise you at all. It's just a bit awkward to know how you can know about them. And indeed, how you can remember them when you're not seeing anything red and you insist in a lecture that the experience of red isn't captured in the physicalist world scheme. Of course, you're remembering the experience of red, and the memory is caused by, well, not by the property you're telling the people in the lecture about, but by purely physical material going on in your brain and in the surroundings. And that was the consideration that eventually made me abandon the argument. The other thing that happened is I became much more sympathetic to representationalism about perceptual experience, the idea that when you have a colour experience, there's a sense in which there's nothing coloured in your experience. What's happening is you're in a state which represents the world as being a certain way. And if you think about experience that way, then you can see how you might respond to the Mary argument.
Well, does that mean that you would respond by saying that actually, if Mary genuinely did have full knowledge, she wouldn't be surprised?
Yes, what you say is two things. First of all, she wouldn't be surprised in the sense that she wouldn't learn anything more about what the world was like. She'd be surprised in the sense in which people who are motion blind, who acquire the ability to see motion, are surprised. They don't think they've discovered a new property. But if you're motion blind, things don't seem to move. I mean, you know there's motion, but nothing has that sort of left-to-right lookish about it. And you can't even imagine what it's like to see motion. It's no use having someone next to you giving you a really vigorous lecture, plonkingly spelled out, telling you what it's like to see motion. That's a waste of time. You don't know what it's like to see motion. And when you see it, there is a surprise. You suddenly know what it's like to see motion. But it's not, in any sense, acquaintance with the new property. So I think what the representationalist can say about what happens to Mary when she leaves the room is she's not surprised in the sense of learning about a new property. But of course she's surprised in the sense that she now knows what it's like to see red in the same sense in which someone who's motion blind, when they get the ability to see motion, they suddenly know what it's like to see motion.
So once you published this as a paper, what kind of reaction did you get?
Well, a lot of it was hostile in the philosophical sense. I don't mean in the personal sense. But there were always a group of people, of course, who were very enthusiastic about the argument. And I meet them in conferences. Now I've changed my mind. And they often come up to me and say, we're very sorry you changed your mind. And I think they feel I've let the side down. There have been books devoted to the argument and nothing but the argument. And if you look at citation counts, both of the papers on the knowledge argument are cited an awful lot.
It'd be interesting to know how long it took you to come up with the argument. Was it something that just occurred to you in a minute?
I just recently read H.G. Wells' book, The Country of the Blind. And you may know in that book, there's a sighted person who lives in the country of the blind. And the people who are blind don't believe he can do anything they can't do. They notice he's rather good at winning fights and avoiding falling down holes. But they just think this is a behavioural capacity. There's nothing else going on except this rather interesting behavioural capacity. And I think that book might have triggered it, a short story. So I thought, hold on, this is quite wrong. It's not just a behavioural capacity. He actually has a whole different access to properties and experiences that the blind people don't have, although they don't know about it.
Well, now that you're back in the world of materialism, are you still left with that mysterious feeling about consciousness and conscious experience that inspires many people to get worked up about qualia in the first place?
I think I've done a reasonably good job of disinfecting myself from my previous opinions. But what I do think, though, is that lots of people who replied to the knowledge argument didn't really explain what was wrong with it. They said lots of really interesting, philosophically illuminating things, but somehow it left people dissatisfied. Somehow the redness of reds wasn't covered. And the reason I like the representationalist approach is that I think that does allow you to say, look, the redness of reds is not a property of your experience. It's a property of the way you're representing the world. So don't think of the redness as some sort of property of a state of you. It's a property that you are ascribing to the world around you. So your visual system is sort of shouting out to you, these objects have got an attention-grabbing, vivid property. But don't think that your experience, in any sense, is red.
Does that mean that I could be having an experience which I call red, but you would call green if you were having it, and vice versa?
Yes. I don't think it's much a problem. I think it's obviously true that people might have very different colour experiences. Indeed, if we imagine discovering a tribe in the Amazon jungle whose brains are systematically transposed with respect to ours, and who have rather curious views about which colours go together, I think you might say, my goodness, when they see ripe tomatoes, what goes on in their brain is like what goes on when we see grass. And when they see grass, what goes on in their brains like what we see when we look at ripe tomatoes? And they seem to say things like, ripe tomatoes are rather soothing, whereas grass is rather attention-grabbing, like the sound of a trumpet. Now, if this happened long enough, I think you'd say, my goodness, they are having transposed colour experiences, so I think we should acknowledge that as a possibility. What the materialist has to say, of course, is that at some level, functional or behavioural or neuroscientific, you can detect this difference. And indeed, the story I just told you is a story where you could do some detecting.
So how could you tell that these people are having similar experiences?
Well, I think it'd be a combination of three things. You look at their brains and you discover that what happens in their brains when they see ripe tomatoes is like what happens in our brains when we see grass. You find out exactly which optical properties of the surfaces of objects they are responding to, and you might well discover that the particular properties their visual system picked out to respond to when they looked at ripe tomatoes actually wasn't the property we responded to. It was some associated properties, more like the properties of grass which stimulates our responses. And finally, there'd be behavioural and functional properties to do with how they discriminated one object from another. But I do think if you found two groups of people who were behaviourally and neurophysiologically and information processing identical, then you'd have to say they had the same experiences.
You've described how you've changed your opinion about the right conclusion to draw from your thought experiment. Is there any chance that you might flip again and go back the other way and say, well, look, actually, I was wrong about physicalism. Dualism is the correct explanation of our state.
No, I don't think so. Since I became a convert to the representationalist picture of sensory experience, since then I think I'm sort of bulletproof or ironclad or whatever the right phrase is against sliding back, which is perhaps a good thing. It'd be slightly embarrassing to change my mind yet again on the subject.
Frank Jackson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nigel, and thank you very much, Dave.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.com. www.mary.ac.uk.